Hi, and welcome to Jesus Over Everything, a five-day-a-week variety show that mixes encouragement, the Bible, practical how-tos, and fantastic guests for the listener on the go. I'm Lisa Whittle, and I welcome you to just 5 minutes with me, which I trust and pray will be 5 minutes well spent. It's my pleasure to welcome best-selling author and podcaster Lisa Jo Baker back to Jesus Over Everything today for a fun and important interview. We talk about a lot of things, how she went from being an attorney to what she does now, about why ordinary love is so underrated, a really honest story about how she failed in public and what that's taught her that's an important lesson for us all, and fun South African facts I was excited to learn from this native. She's fun and wise and all the things we all love, so listen now as Lisa Jo and I talk about why the middle matters. So I was trying to calculate up, and we have probably spent a total of maybe 8 minutes of our lives physically together in one venue or another, right?
I mean, I feel like it was maybe a little bit longer if you figure in all the porch sitting during the rain. We also ate a lot of good food together.
That's true. Yeah. I think we've been to a couple of like writing or artist gatherings of some sort, but it's fun to get to talk longer than we usually do as ships passing in the night for so many years.
I know. I'm really grateful for this.
Oh, it's good. I think we go on each other's podcasts as friends in this sort of industry to get to chat.
Yes. Almost. Yeah, I know, right? It's like, how is this my job? Let's just hang out with Lisa and have a conversation today.
Well, That's so how I feel too. I feel the same way. Just so much respect and love for my friends that are writing books and just speaking Jesus, and you're one of those people. So before I get into your book, talk to me about how you go from being an attorney to doing what you do now, which is a podcaster, author, stay-at-home mom as well, right? I don't know this story. So how do you go from that?
That is a hard question to answer briefly, but I will try.
Maybe it's a bad one. I don't know.
No, but it's a good question.
I'm intrigued because
I'm too
like
wordy. I have to think of the shortcut to give you. Okay. So yeah, shortcut is this. I grew up in South Africa. I always wanted to be a human rights lawyer. I went to law school. I practiced law. We lived overseas and I worked on human rights issues. And at the time, all the while saying, I will never be a mother. Like, that was my thing, right? Like, I am going to change the world and motherhood is not going to be the way I do it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I feel like God was just so patient and gracious and kind, because for my 30th birthday, he gave me babies and I became a mom, and I went through this entire shift in my thinking. What's interesting is that my core, I would say, like, vocation didn't change. I had always wanted to be an advocate for women.
And so
for years, I did that as an attorney and as a human rights lawyer working on anti-human trafficking. And then when I became a mom, and for my 30th birthday, that's what I wanted, is to have babies, and I became a mom, my focus shifted, but my calling didn't, because I continued to advocate for women, but now for moms, for women who weren't sure how to understand their identity now that they were balancing it with motherhood, to keep reminding them that what they do in God's economy is just as significant as any work you might do in the legal field. That's the short version of the transition, but it's interesting because I feel like the passion has remained the same and the skill said, because lots of talking and writing, it's all the same.
No, I think that's so cool, because so many times we can see threads of exactly who we've always been or who we were meant to be. It just does take on different forms, right? I think in our life, and just so the key is like keeping your hands open and saying, hey, I did this then, don't have to always do it, now I'm doing this, you know, right? And God can use me in both capacities. So I love that. You did very well in compiling that.
Yeah, thank you. The hope is we keep growing, you know, and he keeps growing us up into this version of ourselves that he's constantly working on. So yeah, that's been my very surprising transition. And no one has been more surprised than myself.
Yeah, I'm sure. Well, you wrote a book called Surprised by Motherhood.
There you go.
So there you go.
It's because I couldn't fit like shocked, horrified, and traumatized by motherhood on the cover.
Well, I think surprise does say it all. Your new book, The Middle Matters, definitely speaks to me, because of course it's where I am in life,
right?
But what I found when I read it is that it has tons of important lessons for people, not just in that middle age space, but you say the middle is the marrow. So does that mean you're sort of telling people, not there yet, this is when life really gets good?
Right, because I don't think it's a certain age, right? Yeah. I think it's much more about a stage. And some of us get there in our 30s, some of us get there in our 40s, but it's really the stage of our life where we've settled into who we are. Hmm. Like, and our kids are getting older. They're not just, you know, toddling around the living room. They're toddling into high school or college. It's the space. I always talk about how the middle is the place where we may have outgrown the shape of our teenage genes, but we have finally grown into the shape of our souls.
Yeah.
So it's that, that's the marrow, right? That place like in your bones where you start to know who you are and you start to think, okay, what is the mark I'm leaving behind? Like, not, it's not anymore just about like, what can I do? What can I accomplish? It's much more like, what can I leave? What am I leaving behind? What am I passing on? To me, that's more of what I think about when I think about the middle.
Yeah. And I think what listeners need to know about writers is that we feel something deeply. We hear the conversations happening, right? Whether it be at Starbucks, whether it be with our own sort of friend group, online, at church, in our neighborhood, whatever. And we kind of hear these trends. We hear these kind of things that everybody is, and I don't mean trends in a bad way. It's just kind of lack of a better word to say right there. But like we hear these same conversations happening over and over. And they're things that then resonate with us too. Like, this is where I am. This is how I feel too. And that's kind of how we know what to write about. And it's what pierces our heart. It's what means something to us. And we know we're much more alike than what we think. And so many times it's not about like someone in our own age group. We might relate to someone much younger or much older, whatever. It's sort of these human threads, right? That
right,
unite us.
Exactly. Because I started to feel like we live in a culture, I think, Lisa, tell me if you agree with this, that I feel like wants us to believe we're supposed to live a viral life.
Mm-hmm.
It's too much. Like, who can live that way? Like, there are these videos of promposals or engagement photos or these parenting moments that go viral. Nobody lives a viral life. Like, most days I'm trying to figure out new ways to make chicken and like how to run the carpool and have three children in three places at the same time. Like, that's where my life really lives.
Yeah.
But I felt like nobody writes love stories about that.
I know.
We want to celebrate the viral moments, but 99% of our days are lived in the ordinary moments in the middle.
Right.
And those are the moments that define us. And so as a writer, I always feel like maybe like a photographer or an artist captures a memory or a scene with a camera or a paintbrush. I do that with my words.
Yeah.
And I started to pay attention to my life and I thought, you know what? I just do not have the energy to seize the day every day. It's just, it's too much. I can't.
Yeah.
I'm not even capable. Please don't ask me to. I can't stage viral moments. I don't have a viral life. But what I can do is I can see the day. I don't need to seize the day, but I can see it. And what I mean by that is there are these moments buried in our everyday that you could easily pass by without noticing. And I decided that they moved me so much that I wanted to write them down so I'd remember them. So this book I think of as a collection of photographs. It's like a photo album, except the photos are written with words. So it's this collection of essays. And it started because I was at a track meet that my oldest was running in. Beautiful day, blue sky, red track, all these kids running, all these moms like leaning over the fence, right? Yelling like, run, baby, run.
Yeah, of course.
And they don't even have to say their baby's name because every kid recognizes their mom's voice. Like, I get choked up just thinking about it. Like, there are moms yelling as if their child was winning the Olympic medal when their kid was in last place.
Yeah.
And like all the parents then just like take up the cry, right? And they're like clapping and screaming as this kid comes in dead last.
It's the best.
I looked at my husband and I said, I'm going to write this. Like, this moment is a snapshot I want to keep forever. And so that's what I mean about celebrating the ordinary of our lives, because we don't live viral lives. We live ordinary lives, but it's where the word extraordinary comes from, the extra in our ordinary, right? And so that's what this book is. It's a love letter to ordinary life.
Well, it's a really beautiful one. It goes into a lot of middles, as you say, the middle of marriage, the middle of friendship, the middle of your faith. And in the part about your actual middle, where you talk about
top, I write about it. Yes, I do.
I know. I love it. You talk about things like the scale and age not being a dirty word. You talk about the love story of turning 40.
Yep.
And you say in that particular chapter this, it felt brave and beautiful to take care of me. Mm. I've talked online this year about being nicer to myself because, and I think those things go along with each other. I loved your sentence so much, and especially because I think we don't value this enough as women. Mm. I have some reasons I think we don't, but I'm curious to hear why you think it's almost shocking to us when we do care for ourselves. Like we surprise ourselves. We're like, it felt brave and beautiful to just take that bubble bath, you know, or whatever that innate
context,
thing is.
I mean, in this context, it was going to get a mammogram. Like that's what I was doing that day. And it felt so brave and so beautiful to do that. And partially because I, you know, if you go for a mammogram, you're not supposed to wear lotions or deodorant, things like that. And so I really showed up like au naturel, you know, like here I am. And it was the year I turned 40. I think it was a week before my 40th birthday. And my mom passed away when she was 42.
Yeah.
So I had this moment of just thinking, wow, this is me in my skin doing something that's meaningful because I want to take care of me for my family, for the stories they're going to write about me one day in their memories, and to show up in my unfiltered, unvarnished, unmakeuped face, just looking in the mirror, standing there in that robe was such a vulnerable moment, but it also felt really courageous. And I think women are so brave, and there are so many ways that we're brave. We're brave because we take on the aches and pains of our children. We, you know, stand up for kids. We give our voices on behalf of this generation coming up behind us. We advocate, we drive the miles of carpool, we chase our passions and our callings while raising a family. There's just so many elements to the courage of being a woman. And I thought, somehow we talk about this idea of aging as being over the hill, but instead, I have really found it to be like coming into myself, you know, like who the truest version of myself is. And so it was that version that looked back from the mirror that day with no makeup, in her gown, about to get a mammogram. And I just thought, dang, dang, like that's beautiful. That's brave.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I think so many times our women's battle cries are really just sort of heart cries, just
like
to
that.
Like see me, you know, other people see me and even see ourselves, you know. And so I think just even that, we don't even want to say the word self-care because I think we think it's not biblical, it's not scriptural, like there's something that's not right about it, because obviously self-focus is you know, that's not great,
right?
Because we get too self-absorbed, right? And then obviously that's not great. But there's a difference, like self-care is important because obviously God wants us to love who he created, you know, he wants us to take care of who he created. And so we have to really come into balance with that and come into understanding as to what that actually is and what that actually means, and not despise it or resist it or reject it, and also not get too into ourselves. And I think only Jesus can help us keep that balance, right?
Yes,
you know?
I know,
just with everything else,
I mean. And we live in a culture that somehow wants women to be ashamed of their age. It's just crazy.
Yeah.
Like it's a narrative counter to everything scripture says about aging.
That's true.
Everything the culture tells you about wanting to disguise or cover up or downgrade your age, the Bible is telling you, no, like you're finally now have some wisdom, you know?
Right.
Gray is a crown of glory. Like all of these things that our culture wants us to diminish, I feel like in God's economy are what really add value to who we are. And, you know, Lisa, I was doing an interview a while ago and I mentioned my age and the host was a man and he was so taken aback that I said I was 44. He told me, do you want to edit that out? Like, is that okay? And I said to him, are you kidding me? Like, I worked very hard for these 44 years. Like, every single one of them is hard earned. I am very proud of them. You know, I feel like every one of those years is a marker that I've lived longer than my mom. Like, I can't get over the gift of these years. And I think as women, I want to look to the women behind me and pass on anything I can that might help my younger sisters. And if sharing my age does it, then I will do that, you know, with joy.
Yeah.
Ecclesiastes says he has made everything beautiful in its time. Like, everything. That includes us and our wrinkles and our muffin tops. And I refuse to be ashamed of those things. I think that they honor the creator, like this creation and how I've stewarded it honors him.
Yeah. No, I think that's such a good message to also revisit and hear often. And, you know, it's good for me because, to be honest with you, I struggle sometimes with age. I think there are reasons for that. I would preach the same thing over and over again to anyone else. Like, this is, you know, this means that God's letting you live longer. And this means that you've got more time to influence. And this means that you've earned all these years. Like, I would preach that. And on the other hand, I would feel like, oh, I want more time. I want more to do. Like, I don't want the years to slip away. And, you know, it's not so much for me. It's not a vanity thing of I don't want to look older. Mm. It's more of just like, I mourn some of the years I wasted, not being serious about God or not really understanding myself and using my gifts. So I struggle with the age in that way. So this is something that God works on me a lot. So I love and appreciate what you're saying. And I think it's super important to revisit it often, you know, and remember where we are and we're where we are. And it just is. And we can't mourn maybe what was, but where we are now. You talk in the part about middle of marriage, how ordinary is sexy.
Yes.
I found this chapter one of the most beautiful. I've been married for 23 years. Oh. And I've said before that watching my husband push my father around in a wheelchair when he was in the latter stages of his life showed me true love, maybe more than anything else ever has.
Right.
I consider that ordinary love, really, in a way. It wasn't flashy.
100%. Yeah. Sacrificial, ordinary love. Yeah.
Yeah. So why do you think that ordinary love is so underrated?
Because I think there are quotes like this out there. I read, it's like what inspired that whole section is a quote I read on Huffington Post. It's called, they have a teenager quote of the week.
Okay.
And this one said, my life will never be satisfactory until someone has run through an airport for me. Which, of course, is the movie trope, right? Like, they're running through the airport to stop you getting on a flight to declare their passionate love for you, which TSA would never allow these days anyway.
Right.
But, like, what? Like, that's the cliffhanger? That's the end? That's the peak? Like, that is what I must aspire to you? And when I read that, I just thought, heck no. You just haven't lived long enough, you know? Like, your life will never be complete until somebody has watched three kids while you puked for 14 hours.
Like, that's right.
There's the romance or the man who's cleaned up after you, or he drives the rundown minivan without air conditioning in summer.
Like, right.
I think that that's the problem. We have all these movies and stories. And listen, I love a good rom-com as much as the next girl. Do not get me wrong here. Netflix is like my second BFF. I love it all. But I don't want to walk out of a movie theater and forget that my real life is where real love actually lives. Like, I want to pay attention to that. And so I wrote this section because I think we forget. We are comparing the men, the 24/7 men in our lives, to the men we see for 2 hours on a screen, who I promise you go home to their real wives who they're just as ordinary as the next guy.
Yep.
I think part of the beauty of understanding love here in the middle is it's come to mean much more than just that romantic love. It's now got that deep, rock solid foundation of sacrificial love. And that's what shows up in ordinary places. The guy who unloads the dishwasher without being asked. Like, those are the things that keep a life stitched together. And I love the peaks as much as the next girl. I mean, give me romantic nights out. Sure. Bring me tulips. Love it. But you know what? Remember to pick up the kid when I told you to, or fill out the billionth sports physical form without me reminding you. Like, those are the things that knit two souls together over the course of a lifetime. And so for me, I just think it's sexy as all get out commitment.
This is super important because, and listen, I'm not trying to get into some weird debate like with, well, I know you and I won't debate this, but like even with a listener, like some kind of silent debate over the airwaves. But this is why things like 50 Shades of Grey are damaging, because, it, you know, to people's sex life and all these things, because you can't put things like that out there that people then have as some kind of weird standard. Right. And it's like when we're living in this reality that doesn't look like stuff like that in daily life and isn't even supposed to, you know? So,
right. I mean, you know, like all the romance novels and romance movies, like you don't see them go to the bathroom. No one ever has diarrhea or food poisoning. Like nobody ever has a fit because somebody always forgets to turn the lights off. Like the petty things that like make up the grit of a marriage, like it takes to constantly fit that person in and to fit yourself into them, like how it's not about serving yourself. How marriage, I always think it's so funny, you know, Jesus tells these parables, but then he gives us like real-time parables to live. Like marriage is a real parable of what it means to lay down your life for somebody else.
Yeah.
And that is going to change you in ways that will get up in your business and make you more and more into the shape of Jesus. And you can't do that with just, you know, glowy, soft filter, happy endings of
exactly.
You know, living in hotel fairy la la land that, you know, doesn't exist here on Wednesday nights when I have to make dinner again.
Well, you know, what that reminded me of is when my father passed away, my mom had been his caretaker for, well, she really took care of him his whole life, honestly, in so many ways, emotionally in so many ways. But in the last 6 months, almost maybe a year of his life, she was his physical caretaker. Oh, like, and if you saw my parents and the way they looked, my dad was a big guy. My mom is teeny tiny. And so just even the miracle that she was able to lift this man who in the end couldn't even comb his own hair. Mm. He had a degenerative disorder, rare brain disorder that, you know, eventually he just couldn't physically move or anything. In the very end, after he passed, we were lying there, we were waiting on the corner and so forth to come. And my mom said to the hospice nurse that was there, "Can I change his socks?" Oh. And now remember, he's already gone. Mm. And she said, "I've been changing his socks for a year.
Wow.
I just want to change his socks one more time."
Oh my gosh.
And heart. You know, that to me is ordinary love.
Oh, but it's like heavenly,
that's
glory,
everything.
Extraordinary, holy ground kind of love. Yes, that is the real deal right there.
So that's what, you know, that section reminded me of, or really just came to mind right now. So anyway.
That's beautiful.
Yeah. Something I appreciated also in the book was a story you told in your chapter about how to fail in public.
Well, so this is like an event where I'm speaking and like my heroes are other speakers that day.
Right.
Okay. Yeah. And so I have to get up. I speak in front of them. I bomb so badly that when I sit down, Lisa Harper reaches over and just like pats me on the knee. Like you just know, like there's no escaping. It was that bad.
Well, but let's also say Lisa Harper is one of the most gracious, loving. She's the perfect person to bomb in front of, by the way.
And she's one of the greatest speakers. So that was my choice. Like I could either go skulk in my hotel room the rest of the weekend or, and I write about this, I can sit in the front row and show up with my pen and pencil and learn from these women.
I love
because what they do is extraordinary. It's very difficult to be excellent as a teacher who's also really funny and people absorb all their truths. And so I did. I kept showing up. And I stole that line and I actually do credit her in the book. My friend Annie Downs is the one who talks about that, how God will either humble you in private or in public. Mm. And so ask for that private humbling because else he's going to upgrade you to a public version.
Yeah.
And so what's interesting about my experience is that while it's true that it felt like I had bombed in front of this audience, I think only those of us who were speakers could really appreciate the level at which I felt like I had failed.
Right.
So it didn't feel public in that sense. It felt like in my heart, I knew in that small group of women, I knew it was a safe lesson, right? In that sense, it was like, listen, you weren't prepared enough. You didn't quite have a clear vision of where you were going. Here's what it looks like to receive that teaching.
But you still wanted to do great in front of your peers.
Right,
we want that more, you know?
Sure, sure. But I didn't feel like everybody in the auditorium was like cringing on my behalf.
Right. Yeah.
And so that's, in that sense, it's private. Like for me, I've had other moments where I speak at an event where the picture they've used on the signage is like not my pretty bio photo. They've grabbed some random picture off the internet of me and I look terrible. And every time you have to walk past that sign, you feel like, okay, Lord, I received that. Private dose of humility.
Or you're in like a green room that's like you know, a nursery and right. you're, you know, you're yes. stuck in a corner somewhere. I mean, right. these are kind of, I mean, this is not really like a problem, right. But it's, you feel the humbling there. Like, of like,
it's like the Lord just gently reminding you yeah. you're not all that, you yeah. know, like he is using you because he chooses to. He could use anybody he wants. And lucky, like, I truly feel that, like this gift of getting to partner with him.
Right.
And you know, I had that event where I spoke and it just felt like I bombed. And then it was a Lifeway event and I love them and I did this speaking event. It went so bad. And like, that was the beginning of the year. And then at the end of the year, I spoke for them again at an even bigger event. But what was so great is I had learned a lot from that failure and mm-hmm. I had learned a lot from those women and how they taught. So that by the time we got back to the end of the year, I felt like I had really metabolized what I had learned. And so yeah. the experience was really life-giving and wonderful when I spoke for them again. And yeah. I really think that's like, when it comes to failure, like what we do with our failure really matters. Like I could have said, oh, it was unfair because when I had that big bomb, part of what had happened is the timer counting down had dropped from like 15 minutes to zero.
Right.
And the techies hadn't realized it. And so they then started putting like negative and like flashing right. stop now. And so like I stopped in the middle of the talk. Like I could have blamed them. I could have blamed that, you know, there are many things I could have blamed, but instead I was like, all right, I'm going to take this private lesson, Lord. I'm going to learn from it. And thank you. So like 9 months later, that failure is the reason why I felt like when I spoke again to an even bigger audience, I really was in a space where I felt like I owned the message.
Yeah.
In a way I wouldn't have been able to, I don't know, with the same, without that kind of failure. So I think here in the middle is where we learn our failures. They don't define us, but they certainly refine us.
Yeah.
On this mission that God's invited us to be part of with him.
Yeah. I did think that was a really important moment in the book. And I think it's an important lesson is where we go from the failures, what we do with it. I think what you did with it did prove so important. And that's the key is in that moment, what do we want? Do we want to be better? Because if we do, we might have to do the hard thing in that moment, which it feels like a death. It's like a humbling,
it really you know, does.
You are dying.
So bad.
But if you will just suck it up in that moment, I mean, yeah. for lack of a better way to say it, if you know, if you will really just succumb to it in that moment, in the end, you will be so much better. And right. you're right. That lesson then proved to be so powerful and important for the later thing, which was kind of redemption in a way for you.
And it's
so
a lesson, you know what else? It's just like this two-part lesson. Like it's a lesson to me about what I want to get better at, but then it's also a lesson to me about how to help people through a failure like that. Because
right.
here are like the examples, like Lisa Harper was so kind and like reached over and tapped my knee. And one of my boss at the time, Saul Robles from Dayspring and Encourage, he came up after with like my favorite iced coffee and he just handed it to me. He didn't say anything. Like
yeah.
he just gave me this drink. And
yeah.
you know, I had other friends from the Encourage team who met me afterwards and they're like, listen, but here are the good things.
Yeah.
They listed the good things. I just think, you know, we're going to see our sisters behind us have their days where they fail. What does it mean for me then to go be their champion?
Right.
How do I give love in that moment? How do I support them? And so it was a very beautiful and humbling lesson because I was also then receiving comfort from people who had seen me fail and
yeah.
who loved me in a really tangible way so I could get up off my butt and try again. And I just realized in that moment, man, I want to be that for other women too.
Yeah.
I want to be able to say, listen, it's not that bad. Shake it off. Here's how you're going to move forward.
Well, you are in the book and you will be from this point forward because empathy makes for the best leaders. And that's why, you know, the best writers, the best leaders, the best speakers are people who have weathered and gone through things, whether it be failure, whether it be grief, whether it be just not being perfect people, which
right.
none of us are, but
right.
it's a gift because then we're able to walk through that with others and we're able to, I think, have an air of humility that's different. And I don't know. I mean, even when my father went to heaven, I don't know. I just feel a little bit different even than I did
right.
3 years ago. Not that I wasn't empathetic with people then, or, and not that you have to lose someone. I think we can still be lots of things without those things. I'm not saying that, and certainly not having pride in what, you know, you've gone through that someone else hasn't. It's just to say, I do think that when we allow these things like failures to become our friend and to become things that we can launch from, we can use them, and God can use them in such a powerful way to help other people. And that's really the whole point.
Right. I mean, it's why the photograph on the cover of this book, if your readers see a picture or look it up on Amazon, is me. It's so interesting. I'm on the cover of this book, which was not my intention.
Yeah, that's fun.
They were talking about a photo shoot, and when they were mocking up the cover, they were like, well, before we can do a photo shoot, could you just send us a picture so we could have something to place, so we get a sense of what we want to do when we design it? And I sent them this picture that ended up on the cover. It's a photograph one of my best friends snapped in the middle of a kid's birthday party. So I have like my 3-day hair and my chippy nail polish. I have chippy nail polish on the cover of the book. And the designer said to me, hey, would you like me to fill in the nail polish? And I said, no, because I feel like this picture is an accurate representation of the essays in the book. Like, the outside matches the inside, because in our real lives, like, we're never perfectly put together. We are all, but the book is, this cover picture is full of joy. Like, there's this delight at being caught in a photograph in the middle of my completely ordinary life, because I'm learning to see it in a new way. And that includes my failures and ordinary love stories and struggles with doubt and faith and parenting teenagers. I feel like that's why I love this picture, because it perfectly captures just the love story of being in the middle of your completely ordinary life.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a fun picture. It's so good. I love it. So this show is called Jesus Over Everything. I'm wondering how Jesus Over Everything maybe looks different in the middle season, or is it no different?
No, I think it is. I think your faith grows up just like every other part of you, right?
Yeah.
And here in the middle, I've been surprised how much more I've struggled with doubt than ever before.
Hmm.
But the thing that's been consistent is Jesus. Like, he really, his story, how he lived his life, is so magnetic that even though you might have days like my daughter did where she said, Mom, I'm not sure if what I believe is real or if I just made it up in my head, when you look at him as a person, especially because he's grounded in a time, a season, a culture, in stories that are very practical to do with food and sickness and death, there's no denying that. And so I think that Jesus has really been over everything else that I've struggled with in terms of like trying to figure out, as I move into the second half of my life and I take this faith with me, how does it look now? How do I understand it? How does it change me? And what do I leave behind?
Yeah.
It's knowing that Jesus that said, the kingdom of heaven is now. And that has been a radical turning point for me in this season. Because if that's true, if the kingdom of heaven is actually now on earth as it is in heaven, it's not some esoteric place we're going to in the future with angels and clouds. Like, if it actually is now, then making chicken on a Wednesday night somehow has an internal impact. Like, that really blew my mind when I let it sink in to how he describes the kingdom of heaven. Like, the conversation I have that's difficult with a friend, how I show up for the voiceless, how I parent my teenagers. Like, I actually think it will have some eternal reflection that when we get to heaven, we'll see it. The kingdom we built here on earth, we will see there, has radically transformed just my completely ordinary life. And that is how I've really experienced, I think, Jesus over everything in this season.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I feel that. That's good. So we always end on a fun note. People love to hear your real life things. So let's transition a little bit into something kind of lighter.
Sure.
What is, I think I know this based on what you said earlier a minute ago, but what is your biggest guilty pleasure? Netflix or
yes, no, well, it well, is.
Here's your options, A or B, Netflix or dessert.
No, Netflix 100%. But I'm going to pull a Joey Tribbiani and just be like, put those two things together, man.
Oh, yeah. Exactly. Dessert while watching Netflix.
Exactly.
Okay. Childhood nickname. Do you have one?
You know, my Lisa Joe is actually my middle name. My first name is Rachel. But
what?
I know. It's freaky, right? It's like I'm undercover. But that was my mom. She wanted my first name to be Rachel, but everybody always called me Lisa Joe.
Okay. Interesting. Wow. I didn't know that. Okay. Your favorite drink?
Iced vanilla latte.
Nice. What do people say the most about you?
You're so encouraging. How do you do it? How do you not get annoyed with people? Then I think, if only you could hear the conversations in my own head. I have to work hard at it just like everybody else does to love other people well.
Well, I love to have conversations in my own head that only you and Jesus know about. Yep. That's the best thing about the sanctity of our minds, I think. What is the number one thing you look for in a friend?
Oh.
Because you've got a really good friend that was on our the podcast here,
yeah.
Christy, and she's so delightful. So tell me, what do you love about...
I think I would describe it. I don't know if this sounds right, but I think safety, like a place where a person is safe, where you
sounds
know
right to me. Yeah.
They love you and love you through and through, that there's nothing you can say that's going to change that, that they're just a really safe place. Actually, Christy came back recently from overseas and there was something hard I was struggling with, and she'd been out of the country for weeks. We hadn't talked, and I literally left her a message and I was like, hey, welcome home. I have this hard thing I need to talk to you about. I'm just going to jump right in. And she just felt like safe. I could do that.
Yeah, she seems like such a safe place.
She
what a
is.
Lovely woman. Yeah. Bucket list dinner date that is living, a living bucket list dinner date.
Bishop Desmond Tutu.
Ooh, you just go for it, don't you?
I mean, he's amazing. He's my hero. If you don't know who he is, he's the Archbishop in South Africa who spearheaded the Truth and Reconciliation Commission post-apartheid. And he has his work and writing on forgiveness and what it means. And he's, you know, a Black man, obviously, from South Africa, who helped our country move through one of the most devastating injustices ever of, you know, the century. So, yeah.
Yeah,
for sure.
That's a good one. Okay, well, that's a perfect segue into what I'm going to call these next few questions in this segment, South African things.
Oh, yay.
Okay, favorite South African food?
Melk tart, which is like a milk tart. It's kind of like a custardy consistency with cinnamon on it and a really sweet sugar pie crust.
Yum,
I make it here all the time. My daughter asked for one this morning. Yeah, my husband, every year, it's all he asks for. My very American husband. It's the thing all the ladies, the church ladies, will always bring, you know, whenever there's a tea or whatever.
Yes.
It's one of those things.
Now I'm going to crave something I don't even know what
it's
it tastes
so good.
Like. But your description is so good. Okay, what's the best touristy thing? Like, if I'm going to go to South Africa, what do I have to do?
Well, there are many, but
sure.
Obviously you want to go to game reserve. You know, the game preserves are amazing. I have lots of cousins who actually work in the industry as game preserve, you know, rangers. Food is amazing there. One of my favorite restaurants, my kids talk about it all the time, is called Ocean Basket. And it's just the fresh seafood is unbelievable. So you want to do touristy, you know, game park stuff. You want to eat really good food. The wine is obviously amazing. And then you want to go to the beaches.
Oh, okay, well, now I want to go. So
I mean,
this is
obviously.
I don't know if this segment was the best for me to do. All right, what is the thing you miss the most and what is the thing you miss the least?
About South Africa?
Yes.
I mean, I miss my people. I'm not a missionary kid. My family all live there and they're a huge family and they do stuff together all the time. And I'm on their text group where they're like, oh, we're all together at, you know, for Father's Day at this beautiful game reserve with the elephants. And I'm like, stop sending me pictures. not fun for me.
Yeah.
I miss that a lot. There really is, though, a deep sense of insecurity in that country when it comes to crime and safety.
Yeah.
That's real. So it's one of the things we pray over our family all the time, but my family feel called to be there. You know, that's home to them. It's where they plant their roots. My parents have adopted so many kids and they foster a bunch of kids and work very closely with the orphan and vulnerable children community. So,
yeah.
But that's a hard thing.
Yeah. I can imagine. Yeah. What is one little known South African fact? Just like something kind of quirky or obscure.
Well, I don't know if this counts, but a fun thing is to be able to say the phrase thank you very much in Afrikaans. We have 11 national languages. Afrikaans is one of them. And I kid you not, it's pronounced exactly this way phonetically. It's spelled differently, obviously. But thank you very much is buy a donkey.
That is crazy.
I know. And I had no idea until I started dating my now husband. And he was like, why do you keep talking about donkeys when you're talking to your dad? And I was like, what are you talking about, man? Didn't even make the connection.
That is weird.
Yeah.
That is so weird. Okay. Yeah, that counts. That's quirky and little known. And well, I mean, it's little known to probably anybody listening, I would say. Wow. That's neat. Okay. Lisa Jo, last question. I ask it to every guest. What is the last thing you'd say about Jesus if you could only say one more thing?
I think, I don't know if this will make sense to you, but it's powerful for me. I always say, Jesus loves me, this I know, for my children taught me so. I feel like I've understood him the most through becoming a mom. Like, I understand why he would die for me. Because I would like walk in front of a truck for my children without even thinking. And I'm someone who grew up really feeling like motherhood was an obligation the church forced upon women. Yeah. And Jesus in his grace and patience showed me it was a gift that's not an obligation, but it was becoming a mom that really helped me understand his heart. Man, he loves us and he would die for us in a second. And he did.
I think that's precious and makes total sense to me. Thank you so much, Lisa Jo, for coming on. This was a fun and really rich conversation and super important. So thank you.
I'm only sorry we're not having it like sitting out on the Nestor's porch like we were last time.
I'm only sorry that we're not having it over that South African dish, whatever you said.
Yeah.
Well, we'll do that next time. Thanks for coming.
Thanks, Lisa.
Thanks for listening to Jesus Over Everything with Lisa Whittle. If you like what you're listening to, share it with a friend by letting them know about what we do here so they too can be inspired and glean from this community. And hey, if you haven't already, leave a 5-star review on iTunes. It helps so much in making this show what it is and continuing to spread the word about us. You guys are the best.